Welcome to the Federalist Society's podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's State Courts Project, was recorded on Tuesday, January 16, 2018. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum Conference Call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the case for partisan judicial elections, a new white paper by Professor Chris Bono. This paper is the first paper in a new series commissioned by the Society on the leading methods of state judicial selection. My name is Peter Bisbee, and I'm the Deputy Director of External Relations here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of our experts on today's call. Today, we're happy to have with us Professor Chris Bono, the author of the white paper and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh, in addition to Professor Scott Gaylord, Professor of Law at Elon University School of Law. After remarks and discussion between Professor Bono and Professor Gaylord, we'll turn over to question and answer from the audience. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor Bono and Professor Gaylord. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon. This is Professor Gaylord, Scott Gaylord. I want to thank the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum and each of you for taking the time to join in the discussion of this important topic. How should states go about selecting the members of their judiciary? This is important in the abstract, particularly important in my home state, North Carolina, where both the House and Senate are considering different methods of doing it. So very timely, and other places continue to consider and reevaluate their methods as well. It's a pleasure to be on the call with Professor Bono, a nationally known expert in this area. I think what Churchill famously said about democracy, that it is the worst form of government except for all the others, seems to be used by pretty much all supporters of different methods of judicial selection, frequently without a careful examination of the empirical evidence supporting their various claims. There is agreement that there is no perfect way to select judges, but the common ground seems to end there. States obviously have used a variety of different methods, elections, which became popular in the mid-19th century, democratic appointment modeled on the federal system, Missouri Plan, also known as merit selection, which gained support and had its heyday sort of in the 1940s up through the 1970s, and then hybrid forms developed as well, where a commission nominates a candidate, the governor appoints, and a democratic body confirms. And of course, there are variations within each of these different types of systems. Each method balances different values in different ways. States must consider the level of independence of their judiciary, accountability, separation of powers, the quality and characteristics of their judges, and the overall legitimacy of their courts. This is an important and difficult procedure, and I don't think it's surprising at all that courts have adopted various methods to select their judges and when confronted with these different options. As the United States Supreme Court recently noted in a case called Williams-Yulee versus Florida Bar in 2015, the debate over judicial elections goes all the way back to the founding. They've been discussing and debating judicial elections for more than 200 years. As many of you know, Hamilton advanced the federal model, defended it in a Federalist Number 78, where the president appoints with the advice and consent of the Senate, and the federal judge serves during good behavior, which is effectively a lifetime appointment. This is probably the method I think most people are familiar with, especially after the contentious confirmation hearings in recent years, and is frequently held up as a paradigm by critics of other forms of judicial selection. On the other hand, Jefferson and the Anti-Federalists believe that the complete independence of the federal judiciary made judges dependent on none but themselves and ran counter to the principle of what Jefferson said was, quote, a government founded on the public will, end quote. Although the federal courts reflect the view of Hamilton, most states have sided with Jefferson, with roughly 38 states using some form of election for state court judges. In his white paper, Professor Bono contends that partisan judicial elections are the best way to select judges. Professor Bono, thank you for taking the time to discuss your work with us. Would you mind giving everyone on the call an overview of your white paper?
Sure. Thanks so much, Scott, and thanks everybody for joining in. So what the white paper argues is that while, as Professor Gaylord mentioned, there is no perfect method of judicial selection, and certainly one of the great benefits of federalism is it allows states to balance competing values in a way that they think works best in their state. When we're looking at the goals of judicial selection and what we're trying to do, partisan elections provide the most advantages and the least amount of disadvantages, particularly in comparison to other elected forms, such as retention elections and nonpartisan elections. And there are three criteria on which partisan elections are superior. The first is the information that is provided to the voters. We all know that liberal judges and conservative judges, Democratic judges and Republican judges view the law differently, and that's okay. The kinds of decisions that state Supreme Court justices are making are policy-making decisions. These are hard cases. These are cases where the law is not clear. These are cases where different points of view can interpret facts differently or interpret the law differently. And so, you know, there's a reason why there are battles, for example, in the U.S. Supreme Court for who should get to sit in the U.S. Supreme Court, because we know that Merrick Garland and Neil Gorsuch view the law very differently. Equally qualified, equally distinguished, but they view the law differently. Because that's a fact of life, we should give that information to the voters. And in the current environment particularly, the best cue to tell a voter how a judge is going to decide the case is their ideology, whether or not they're a Democrat or a Republican. And so because this piece of information is available to elites, it's available to anyone else involved in the selection of judges in an appointment system, it should also be available to the voters to allow them to make a decision, to allow them to elect a judge that best represents what they think the law should be or how they think, you know, the law should be viewed. And this is true even when you go downstream. Any lawyer will tell you when they walk into a courtroom, when they see who the judge is, they're either very happy or very sad. And again, that's okay, right? But it means that Democratic judges and Republican judges view the law differently. The second criteria is choice. Partisan elections provide meaningful choice to the voters. And this is particularly in contrast to retention elections. In retention elections, voters don't have a choice. They can either keep the judge or not keep the judge. But they have no say over who the judge's replacement should be. They have no idea if the replacement is going to be better or worse for them than the current judge. In partisan election, you have a choice. And because the parties are involved in the selection and vetting of candidates, you have choices, right, between people with different points of view. This maximum amount of choice allows voters to have a much more impactful role in the staffing and of their state court bench. And the third criteria in which partisan elections are superior is transparency. We all know that the notion of apolitical judicial selection is a myth. Politics is involved no matter how judges are selected. So the question is whether or not you want your politics to be upfront, as in an election format, or behind closed doors, where you don't know what's going on and then a nominee just emerges. Right? In a democracy, we should generally prefer more transparent procedures to less transparent procedures. Now, transparency can be messy, and it can be ugly, and sometimes we don't want to see how the sausage is made. But a transparent system allows us to see how the decision makers are behaving, what factors matter, what factors don't, and if we see anything we don't like, we can easily correct it. And so the transparency of partisan elections is also a huge advantage in, compared to appointment systems in terms of how judges are selected.
Thank you. That's a lot of different important issues that you raise with those three things. I was wondering maybe we could take some of those in order. One thing that struck me and doesn't go directly to those three points, at the outset of your paper, you talk about how partisan judicial elections, quote, enjoy particular scorn, end quote, among judges, academics, and commentators. And I was wondering your thoughts on why do you think partisan elections have been singled out for such intense criticism, one, and then related to that, why it still sort of hung out and survived. Again, seven states use partisan elections, but 38 states use elections in some form or other.
So partisan elections have been singled out, in particular because of the fact that they're more transparent, that partisanship is right out there in front. They also tend to involve relatively high amounts of campaign spending. Partisan elections are also more likely to involve campaign advertising and negative advertising. And so the same people who dislike negative advertising and dislike the kind of perpetual campaign and so on in legislative elections are also not going to like it for judges. There's also concern that partisan elections erode legitimacy because judges don't represent parties, and so there's no representative function of judges there. And, of course, the empirical evidence on that is that there is no decrease in legitimacy with partisan elections or with elections more generally in terms of legitimacy of the court. You know, that concern, while a valid concern, we should feel good that, in fact, the empirical work that's been done, namely by my colleague Jim Gibson, has shown that, in fact, that elections can have a legitimacy conferring capability on the court and don't serve to erode elections. And while there are costs, there are also benefits. In terms of why 38 states continue to have them, voters like electing judges. And anytime you ask the voters whether they should get rid of electing judges, they overwhelmingly decide to keep electing judges. Even in states like North Carolina, who have made some changes, and Minnesota, who have been considering changes for a while, when you do surveys of the electorate, anywhere from 2/3 to 3/4 of the public prefers to elect their judges. They prefer to keep the control over that. And so part of the reason why there haven't been why these states have done it is they have judicial elections in their constitution. It's very difficult in many states to amend their constitution, and given the support judicial elections have with the voting public, it's really not a winning issue.
Great. Now, you raise, I think, a question a lot of folks have about partisan judicial elections in your discussion there about campaign financing and the threat of large sums of money. Now, we'll come back to some of the other points. I think maybe it's a good time maybe to follow up with that. You know, in the wake of decisions like Caperton, where individual makes the CEO of Massey Cole makes $3 million of independent expenditures in support of a candidate in Citizens United, and the alleged threat of, you know, large sums of money coming into the process and sort of overwhelming the process. Critics of partisan judicial elections, you know, including Justice O'Connor, when after she went off the bench, have argued that, you know, quote unquote, justice is for sale, or that money is undermining the confidence in the judiciary. Now, those could be two separate issues, justice for sale and the legitimacy. In your view, are either of those types of claims justified?
Well, these are important claims, so it's important to say that these are the most serious claims one can make against judicial elections. The good thing is they're not empirically supported. I mean, if we take even the Caperton case, which, you know, to me is, so Justice Benjamin ended up voting against Massey Energy 81% of the time prior to that case. The sum total of the amount of money that Justice Benjamin cost Massey Energy because of those decisions was about $135 million. Whereas in this one case, it was, I believe, $50 million. So if you look, the Massey Energy is in the hole for about $80-something million. So, I mean, if that's buying a judge, that's a pretty bad investment, I would think. You know, there's just no systematic evidence that justice is for sale. What the evidence does suggest is, yes, judges have to raise money to run for elections, and justices do raise money from attorneys and from business groups and from interest groups who have interests before the court, much as members of Congress do. When they're running for office, and members of the state legislature, and so on. What you don't see is a judge who ordinarily would have voted one way all of a sudden vote the other way in the interest of a campaign contributor. That just doesn't happen. And you don't expect that to happen because campaign contributors behave rationally. You're not going to give money and try to elect a judge who you don't already know sees the law the way you do or agrees with your values. So what's happening is you have people on both sides, both liberals and conservatives, donating money to like-minded candidates to get them elected to the bench. Now, we may think that's problematic, and there's certainly an argument for that, but that's different than saying justice is, in fact, for sale. On the issue of the second part about the legitimacy, it is true that voters are very concerned about the appearance of impropriety when campaign contributions are involved, and empirical data has shown that. This is a very serious concern. The results also show that it's the same for members of the legislature as well. So voters are distrustful of campaign contributions and the effect that campaign contributions have on political decision makers, regardless of the office. This is not something that's unique to courts. So what we have in this country is we have a perception problem with elected officials, and this extends to legislative officials and judicial officials as well. And that's something that we, you know, if policymakers are concerned about, should really focus on, because it's something that's pretty universal. But this is not unique to courts. And if we're going to use this as an argument to get rid of electing judges, despite the benefits, then we also have to make this argument to get rid of electing legislators as well.
In terms of the concern, obviously a very important one, as you note, with respect to large sums of money coming in, and not only if there's an actual threat of corruption or something, but even the perception of it. On the flip side, has the empirical evidence or research indicated any benefits from increased spending?
Well, sure. I mean, increased spending provides more information to voters in elections. And this is where the transparency comes in. And this is why disclosure laws are good, right? The more transparent we can make the process, the better. And so we're in a situation with judicial elections where very few people show up to vote for judge. in terms of showing up to the polls just to vote for judge, right? They show up to vote for president and governor and these other offices. And while they're there, they may or may not fill out their ballots and continue to vote for judge. But no one, even probably the judge's own family, isn't showing up just to vote for him or her. Or maybe. but what happens is the more money that's spent on these races, the more voter participation you get, right? So given that people show up at the polls to begin with, the more money that's spent by candidates, the more likely people are to vote in that race. And the reason for that is information, that you know, they're providing information to the voters, and voters participate when they feel like they have enough information to make a meaningful choice. And so on the positive side from campaign spending, having a lot of campaign spending and having voters be informed about the candidates and make decisions is far more preferable, right, from a democratic accountability standpoint, than having no campaign spending and voters just simply flipping a coin.
And building off of that, in the paper you mentioned the effect of party affiliation on voter participation, and I think you're just talking about voter roll-off in terms of when you go down ballot and get to, you know, those offices like judicial elections that are lower on the ballot, and if you don't have straight ticket voting, straight party voting, what is the impact of, or what has your research indicated the impact of knowing party affiliation is on voter roll-off? Positive, negative, and to what extent?
Yeah, so voter roll-off, right, is just to be clear on the definition, right? So let's say 100 people show up at the polls and 80 people vote for state Supreme Court. We would say voter roll-off is 20%, right? 20% of the people who voted in the election didn't vote for the state Supreme Court office. And what we find is that, so in this case, right, lower levels of voter roll-off mean higher levels of voter participation. And party identification is a huge bonus for voter participation, right? You have lower rates of roll-off on average. Right, in some states it's around 5%, and on average, if I'm remembering correctly, it's around 12% in partisan elections. Not that high, whereas in nonpartisan elections or retention elections, it's well over 20%. So, party ID again provides information to the voters and allows the voters to make a decision. You know, also along those lines, right? Straight ticket voting is present in every state that has partisan elections, and so anybody who goes in and votes straight ticket, you get your vote for judges registered. Interestingly, in nonpartisan elections, if you have straight ticket voting in a state that has nonpartisan judicial elections, voter roll-off increases. There's less voter participation. And the reason for that is it's kind of a double-edged sword. One is nonpartisan elections, right? First of all, providing less information to voters because you don't know which candidate is the Democrat, which candidate is the Republican, which is the liberal, which is the conservative, and so on. But you also have voters who go in and vote straight ticket in these states and think they voted for judge, but in fact they haven't because it's not a partisan race. They have to vote separately even if they vote straight ticket. This happened to me when I was voting in Michigan for years, many years ago. I never once voted for judge in Michigan because I would go in, I'd vote straight ticket, and I'd leave. And I'd go back to my office, and I'd be like, oh, I screwed up, and I know better. And so if I know better and I'm doing this, you wonder how many people think they voted for judge and in fact haven't. And so in nonpartisan elections, particularly those with straight ticket voting option, you get lower amounts of voter participation.
And what happens in terms of, I think you touch on this in the white paper, just turnout generally in situations where you have public participation in either nonpartisan or in particular retention elections? I mean, you won't necessarily say roll off if you're just going for retention, but what happens to turnout generally?
Well, turnout's hard, right? Because so what you have is if you have states that have elections at off times, right, then you get a much lower amount of voter turnout. So you think about Wisconsin, right, which holds, you know, their elections in like April, if you want to guarantee people don't vote for something, have an election on Tuesday in April, sometimes in an odd numbered year. We can look at turnout in those cases. But in general, you know, the turnout aspect of judicial elections is determined by the higher level ballot, and not so much from anything that's going on in that race.
Okay. Turning back to the 3 points you'd made, the first one you were talking about was one of the advantages of partisan elections being the information that's revealed, and I think as you mentioned in the white paper. That is often viewed as one of the strongest criticisms of judicial elections, right? The type of information that you're given here. On this view, judges are supposed to be neutral, such that party affiliation is not, or you know, at least should not be relevant to the judicial selection process. I know you touched on this a little bit in your remarks. I was wondering if you might be able to say a little more about that, given, I think, what a strong criticism and how widely held that is among some critics of partisan judicial elections.
Sure. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the argument that politics shouldn't be a part of it. Maybe not, but I'll concede the point. But it is. And it is no matter how judges are selected. If you go the appointment route, right, we already talked about the Merrick Garland, Neil Gorsuch issue at the U.S. Supreme Court. You can look at the state level reappointments with Governor Christie in New Jersey not reappointing some judges to the New Jersey Supreme Court because he didn't like the way they were deciding cases. And that's his right, right? In New Jersey, you have to be reappointed after your initial term. And the governor is under obligation to keep you on there. Right, so politics is involved in judicial selection. The question is, do we want it up front? Right? Do we want to see the politics? Do we want to be involved in it? Do we want to make choices? Or do we want to have the elites make those choices for the voters? We can go back and you can look at the number of votes against Justice Alito or the number of votes in the U.S. Senate against Justice Sotomayor, both eminently qualified people to sit in the U.S. Supreme Court. But there's no reason for, if politics had nothing to do with it, and we didn't think that there was a difference or it mattered how people viewed the law, you know, then we wouldn't have 30-plus senators voting against both those individuals. Moreover, we'd see a lot more unanimous cases at the U.S. Supreme Court. We wouldn't see bitter divisions at the U.S. Supreme Court. At the state Supreme Court level, these are also policy-making judges. These are the courts of last resort in the state. If it's a state issue, these are the final arbiters. You can think about issues that are present in states from education financing to tort reform. These kinds of big issues that exist in the states that the federal government has no role in at all. Decisions made by the state Supreme Court in that state are vitally important. So it's not surprising that politics will play a part. But it would play a part if it was the governor appointing from a commission or the governor appointing subject to Senate confirmation or if it's the voters making the choice themselves. I mean, the only way to have an apolitical situation, right, we'd have everybody who's interested and qualified for the state Supreme Court, you know, put their name in a hat and we can draw lots. And that's fine, right? It settles some ties in state legislative elections, like in Virginia. But that's the only way to have an apolitical way of selecting judges.
Sure. That by itself, and as you mentioned, doesn't get rid of the political nature of the decisions that may result and then would limit the accountability side of things on the back end.
Exactly.
In your paper, you also discuss the importance of choice and having meaningful choice in the given situation. I think, you know, in terms of, you also mentioned the legitimacy of state courts, the Supreme Court has recognized sort of the legitimacy concern as, quote, the vital state interest in safeguarding public confidence in the fairness and integrity of the nation's elected judges, end quote. So obviously a high interest, I think the Supreme Court talks about as a compelling state interest. How does choice reinforce the legitimacy of state courts?
Yeah, and this is where we get into some interesting work by Jim Gibson, some of his colleagues, that, you know, when you're dealing with legitimacy and you're dealing with elections, what you have to do is just look at what are the costs, right, and what are some of the benefits, right? And so if you're looking at the costs, you're looking at things like messy campaigns, you're looking at judges, you know, taking campaign contributions from lawyers and other people who might appear before them. On the benefits, you're looking at the fact that if you have an electoral process and the electoral process runs as it should and the person with the most votes wins, then the voters feel as if the process worked, even if your candidate didn't happen to win at that time. And so what Gibson does is he does a three-wave panel survey of voters in Kentucky. And he surveys them before the election, you know, right after the election, and then a few months down the road. And what he finds is that perceptions of legitimacy of the court increase after the election, right? There is a net increase after the election, right, than there was beforehand. So after having gone through the campaign process, having gone through the electoral process, people, right, in Kentucky, right, now I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, the single state issue, have higher perceptions of legitimacy than they did at the beginning of the process. Why is that? Well, because the electoral process is one of the most sacred elements of our system of government. And when it works and people feel like it works well and they feel like the election was fair and they feel like everything, then this gives legitimacy to the court. Says the system worked. Now, people who don't come from states that elect judge may look at this and be horrified. Right? I've given talks in states that don't elect judges, and they think this is, you know, they're looking at me like I have two heads. So certainly, if you are from a state where you don't elect judges, and your state legislature said, you know what, we're going to elect judges next year, and next thing you know, you have million-dollar campaigns and all these ads or whatever else, I suspect you will suffer a legitimacy decrease. Because people aren't used to it. This is not how things are done in your state. But if you come from a state with a long history of electing judges, some of these states have been electing judges since the 1820s, this is just how it's done. And when the system works, why would you think it's not legitimate?
And obviously, 38 states or so have elections at some form or other, so not all that many states don't have it. And what is it, Virginia and South Carolina have legislative elections, so in some sense they're used to voting for it, but just in a very different form or venue for it.
Correct.
Yeah. How about in terms of the choice aspect of it, then, the importance of choice, does the incumbency advantage make such a choice illusory? I mean, are incumbents retained so often that the accountability is more theoretical than actual in those states or those situations where you have the incumbent running?
So when you're looking at partisan elections, the reelection rate is in the 70s, right, which is high.
Mm-hmm.
But U.S. House is about, 94%, 95%? U.S. Senate, 90%, 92%. Governors are in the 80s. So in partisan elections, it's lower, right, than these other representative institutions. It's really high in retention races where you just have, you know, check yes or no. But in partisan elections, and even to some extent nonpartisan elections, the reelection rate is high, but it's not inevitable. And we want to be careful about attributing too much to a re-election rate as well. I mean, because re-election rate can be symptomatic of two different things, right? It can be a symptomatic of the fact that incumbents never lose, so there's no accountability because voters don't really have a choice because these guys are always going to win. Or it could be that these people are actually doing their job well, right? Why is the re-election rate for Congress so high, even though people hate Congress? Well, because they think their member of Congress is representing their interests well and doing well, and so they want to continue to vote. But the problem with Congress isn't my congresswoman, it's yours. And so we have a high reelection rate, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's no accountability. In a system of perfect accountability, right, where our representatives were perfectly responsive and responsive to our needs and our wants, right, the reelection rate would be 100%. Not because of lack of competition, but because they're doing their job.
Great. And what about in terms of retention elections? I think you talk about in a little bit in the white paper as well, and their impact on the choice and the ability of voters to make informed decisions at the voting booth. What's your sense of that with retention elections?
Well, you know, by that metric, they're institutional failures, right? Because the voters don't have a choice. You simply know, should you keep Judge Brown, yes or no? And you don't have any say over, you know, who will replace that judge, as I mentioned earlier. The other issue with retention elections is it's kind of unfair to the incumbent judges because there are no filing deadlines. So in partisan races and in nonpartisan races, candidates have to declare by a certain point. So I know if I'm running for re-election, if I don't have an opponent by June, what that means is that I'm, you know, I can coast. I don't have to worry about raising money. I don't have to worry about doing campaign events. I know I'm going to be re-elected. But in retention elections, they don't have that luxury. And so you could think you're going to be fine. And then 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the election, someone comes in and drops a $2 million ad buy on you trying to get you defeated. And because you haven't done any campaign events, because you haven't raised any money, you're caught flat-footed and can't effectively respond. And then you're also campaigning against nobody. You can't contrast your record against an opponent in a retention election because you don't have an opponent. So who are you running against? I was in Nevada in 2010 when right before the election, Harry Reid, Sharon Engel. And Harry Reid's approval at the time was in the 30s, and he was, you know, if there had been a retention election, Harry Reid would have lost. But there wasn't. He had an opponent. And you may think, oh, I don't like Harry Reid. But Sharon Engel's crazy. Like, we don't want her representing us. Right? And so the ability to contrast you and your position and your way of looking at things with an opponent is invaluable in a democratic system.
In terms of the third characteristic you talked about, transparency, I know you've mentioned it a couple different times, and the importance of that and how partisan judicial elections are transparent in the sense of getting that politics out in front, out of doors. I mean, this is one of the reasons in the mid-19th century so many states shifted, is they were concerned about the backdoor politics, the sort of capture of state judiciaries by legislative branches that were doing a lot of the appointments. In the, as I mentioned, 1940s and going forward, the Missouri Plan merit selection became much more popular. Obviously, that stalled in recent decades. But what's the relationship between the nominating commissions and transparency? And maybe you can say a little more about the Missouri Plan, just for those listeners who may not be as familiar or from some of the, 13 states that have those.
Yeah, so the Missouri Plan, otherwise known as merit selection, or I like to use commission retention, because, you know, I mean, merit selection is a great term. I mean, who's against merit? I mean, everyone's for merit, right? Well, yeah. So that's why I like to use a less loaded term than the proponents use. So in this system, there's a commission that's composed of some attorneys, some lay people, maybe some politicians. It really varies based on state, the size or whatever, based on state. It varies based on state. And what they do is they give the governor a list of nominees for every vacant judgeship. It can range from 3 to 5 nominees. And the governor is constrained from picking somebody off that list. Now, in some states, the governor can refuse the whole list and send it back to the commission if the governor doesn't like whoever's on there. That's the general gist. And then after a period of time, they stand for a retention election where the voters are asked, should Judge X keep her job, yes or no? If Judge X gets a majority of yes votes, she keeps her job, except in New Mexico where she needs 57 and Illinois where she needs 60%. And then she serves for a period of time, anywhere from 6 to 12 years, and then she faces the voters again. If she loses, then the vacancy is filled by the same process just described. Commission gives less names to governor and so on. So that's that. Now, there's variation in terms of transparency in these systems. So some systems, like Arizona, are pretty transparent, where the meetings of the commission are published. They're open to the public. The public can speak and give their views on some of these judges, right? So this is, you know, a pretty transparent, you know, system for a nomination. Most states aren't that transparent, though. And in many states, what happens is nothing is published, nothing is open to the public. It's all behind closed doors. And then after a period of time, you know, it's kind of like, you know, voting for Pope. The commission goes in, they close the doors, nothing in, nothing out, and then poof, when you have white smoke, you know you have a list of nominees. And so this doesn't allow for any kind of transparency at all. The public has no voice. They have no voice in selecting these commissioners. They have no voice in retaining these commissioners. They have no voice in who these commissioners are discussing. They can't give their opinions on the people that are being discussed. There's absolutely no public input in these things all. And while there are a non-trivial number, in some cases a majority of these commissions, that are composed of lay people, overwhelmingly, these lay people tend to be political, business, social elites. You're not getting your kind of average person serving on these committees. You're getting small business owners. You're getting doctors. You're getting other kinds of you know, community elites.
It sounds like that type of system. Again, there's a wide variation between and among Missouri Plan commission retention states, but in addition to transparency, then it sounds like there could be an accountability concern, or at least important consideration with respect to accountability if these folks are appointed and appointed by different groups or different political groups or parties or the bar or whatever it may be, and then particularly if it's not transparent, how do you go about holding individuals accountable, especially if the governor has to pick one of 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever nominees that come to her?
Exactly. There's zero accountability in that system.
Okay.
For the commissioners, yeah.
Another criticism, and I think you touch on this, but and I think another significant criticism that you hear with respect to judicial elections generally and partisan judicial elections in particular, that elected judges are not as qualified as appointed judges, that the federal system, as sort of the paradigm, gives us, quote-unquote, better judges under some measure or other. Is from your research and study in this area, is this an actual or perceived problem with judicial elections?
So measuring qualifications is really difficult. Mm-hmm. What do we mean by qualified? Do we mean, you know, did they go to better law schools or not? Do we mean, do they get overruled more often or not? Do we mean, do they get disciplined more often or not? So it's qualifications are hard, right? So that being said, scholars have looked at this a number of ways, looking at like where you get your law degree from, to, you know, to are you overruled and so on. And with the possible exception of discipline, at the trial court level, there are no differences between elected judges and appointed judges. Now, sure, we can point to some, you know, nut cases who somehow got elected to the state Supreme Court, and those make for nice stories. But on average, there are no differences. And the advantage of elections is when you get somebody who's unqualified or you who doesn't do a good job, you can get rid of them very easily. They can just be defeated in the next election. You have to go through an impeachment to try and get them impeached or do any other kind of removal process. So there's a self-correcting mechanism in judicial elections that you don't have in other forms of judicial selection. So there's no difference on average on any of these things between elected judges and appointed judges. Again, with the possible exception of there's been some evidence that elected judges in Florida tend to be more often disciplined than their appointed counterparts. But again, you know, you can look at the federal system as well and see we have judges who are forced to resign and judges who are impeached or whatever else. There's no guarantee, right, that you're going to get somebody, that someone's going to do a good job. But voters don't do any worse than other decision makings in identifying whether or not someone will do a good job.
Okay. And it's sort of a question, self-interest, because of what's going on in my home state of North Carolina. North Carolina had gone to nonpartisan elections for a period of time, has just recently shifted back to partisan judicial elections. I know your paper is obviously supporting and arguing in favor of partisan elections, but between partisan and nonpartisan, if a state is trying to consider and think about, you know, which is better, you obviously argue for partisan. What in particular, if you had to hit sort of the two or three highlights between those two methods, both using elections, both providing for some choice or transparency or whatever else, why do partisan elections stand out above nonpartisan in your estimation?
Well, the big thing is the information they provide to voters.
Okay.
That, you know, they provide voters with a crucial piece, I would argue the crucial piece of information in allowing them to make their decision. And that is, how does this candidate view the law? How does this candidate see the courts or see the role of a judge? Now, this isn't a perfect cue, right? There are, of course, obviously exceptions. But in general, right, we try and design institutions, try and design systems, you know, in general, on the average, right, to maximize the likelihood. Right, and partisan elections provide that information in a way nonpartisan elections don't. Nonpartisan elections pretend that, in fact, there are no differences between how Democratic judges and Republican judges see the law. If we had nonpartisan elections for the U.S. Supreme Court, you can imagine a situation where Merrick Garland and Neil Gorsuch would be running against each other. If it was a nonpartisan election, we would not get to know, right, which party these judges affiliate themselves with. Would that be a good system? I would argue no, right? It would be a far better system if we gave voters the same information that the elites have. Right, the party elites know. That's why they help nominate candidates. That's why they work for candidates. That's why they appoint certain judges as opposed to other judges. So why ought we not let the voters know as well?
And in relation, I know this goes a little bit away from the white paper, which is really looking at those states that have invoked public participation, looking between partisan, nonpartisan, and commission retention. But in terms of the strengths and weaknesses, or at least some of them between, say, a federal model, you know, where states have some type of governor appointment with advice and consent of either their state senate or both houses, or even, say, in Virginia or South Carolina where you have legislative elections, how do you weigh the positives and negatives of those types of more federal model variations with partisan judicial elections?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's why, again, getting back to the whole notion of federalism, I think, you know, if states want to go that route, that, you know, more power to them. I do, but there is evidence that in judges that are appointed either by the legislature or by the governor, they are far less likely to engage in judicial review. They are less likely to strike down laws that have been passed by the legislature and the governor than they are if they're elected. Why? Well, because they're dependent upon these people for their jobs to be reappointed. And so you have a situation where elections give the courts their own independent source of power. If we want the courts to be independent, an independent branch of government as they're designed to be, then they ought to have their own source of power. It shouldn't be derivative on the other two branches of government. That said, I mean, you know, the federal model works fine, apparently, for the federal government, although you can see a lot of vacancies that go unfilled. So if you think about trying to staff vacancies, if you have a divided legislature and governor, where the governor is appointing but the Senate's refusing to confirm, or you have vacancies that are going on for a long period of time, you don't have that in elections. Sure, when a judge leaves the bench in the middle of his or her term, they get filled by appointment. But there's an election coming up in the next 2 years. So regardless, you're going to have somebody on that seat very, very soon. And so it takes that out of it takes that whole political process, right, and removes it from the states. The other thing, too, is about too much independence can be a bad thing. We want to balance independence and accountability. We want judges to be able to feel free to make decisions, hard decisions that people might not agree with. At the same time, we don't want judges to do whatever they want. If we have a system like the federal system of life tenure, there's no accountability at all. There's nothing to stop any judge from deciding any case the way he or she feels free, regardless of the law, regardless of the facts. That's probably not a great system to have.
Certainly, I think Brutus, back in the Anti-Federalists and Jefferson and Jeffersonian Republicans, in the wake of Midnight Judges and Chief Justice Marshall, I think would agree wholeheartedly with that, certainly. So, well, I want to thank Professor Bono for sharing his insights and now open the discussion to questions from our listeners.
Thank you so much, Professor Bono and Professor Gaylord. So let's go to the audience for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Now, as we're waiting for some questions to come in, I will point you to the Federal Society's website on state judicial selection, statecourtsguide.com. It's a great way to check out the ways in which all the different states select their state court judges.
Hi, I have a question. This is John Guzet with the John Locke Foundation in North Carolina. My question is, has there been any research to try to determine which of the various systems is most likely to result in originalist judges ending up on the court?
So I have not seen anything like that. Brian Fitzpatrick of Vanderbilt University has done a study looking at ideological skew of judges, looking at the judges who end up emerging from each method of selection and comparing that to the ideology of the state. And what his work has found is that judges that come out of commission systems or merit selections tend to have the highest skew, so the highest difference between the judges on the bench and the ideology of the state. And it's a leftward skew, that all methods of selection have some sort of skew to the left, but it's highest in the commission retention states.
Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. Any additional questions for the professors?
Chris, have you seen any trends of the last decade or so in terms of state judicial selections, or states just been sort of trying to still figure it out as they go along?
Yes, they've been moving, you know, so West Virginia switched from partisan to nonpartisan elections recently. North Carolina has gone back and forth and back and forth. In the early 2000s, Arkansas switched from nonpartisan to partisan. So the move has been mostly so it used to be the move was all from partisan to retention, to commission retention states. That's dried up. No state has done that since, I believe it was Utah was the last state to do that, although it might have been Tennessee. But anyway, no state's done that in 20-ish years, maybe more. And part of the reason is a lot of state constitutions say the judges have to be elected, but they may not say how. And so you can change from partisan elections to nonpartisan elections simply by passing a statute, as opposed to amending the Constitution to move away from elections. But that's, you know, so that's the move that's been done recently. West Virginia's first nonpartisan election will be this year, I believe. I don't think 2016. I think 2016 was still partisan. But this, it might. I don't want to be pinned down on that, but they did it very recently.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like we have an additional question. Hold on for the next question.
Hi, this is Chris Garvey. I'm an occasional libertarian candidate for various offices in New York. And also the conservatives have several times nominated me as a judge in the Bronx. And my experience in the Bronx as a judicial candidate, well, the reason I was nominated was because the Democrats had said you can take cross nominations from all the other parties, but if you take the conservative nomination, they'll be hell to pay. So in order to fill out their ticket, the conservatives needed some lawyers, and I was nominated several times. Generally, the results were $300,000 for blank, void, and missing, $88,000 for the Democrats and various cross endorsers, and then $5,000 or $3,000 for me. And so that was my experience as a candidate here in New York. And the effect of our judicial system, where it kind of requires a judicial convention, because to get enough signatures to be on the ballot is almost impossible. Second Circuit tried to reverse that, but the Supreme Court overturned them. And the effect of that on, say, an election for district attorney in Suffolk is that the bipartisan Board of Elections decides that since you're not one of the choices of the two major party bosses, they don't want you on the ballot and they throw you off. And then the judges who have to decide the review of the bipartisan Board of Elections, which usually chooses only one candidate for numerous offices, they decide that, well, since we have to be renominated every 7 years, we don't want to offend the people who renominate us, so you're off the ballot. That's just my experience, and you might care to comment on that.
I don't know at all about the specifics of that in particular case. What I will say is, if we went to an appointed system, do we think the results would be any different? Right? But it seems like, you know, in that situation, you have to basically get appointed anyway.
But sometimes the judges, if they're appointed for life, like the federal judges, they can develop a conscience and not worry about losing their jobs.
Yeah, so we could do a couple different things, right? Right. So if that's the issue, right, then there are ways to heal on the back end. So, for example, we could go to a single non-renewable term, right? I think life tenure in general, right, if we were designing a system today, I don't think we would ever put life tenure for anything. And I know very few proponents of life tenure, even among people who like the federal system. Just because life tenure, you know, makes sense when average life age is like 60. It doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense when average life expectancy is now and you can be on the court for 40 years. But you could have a single non-renewable term, right? So you could say, okay, you're going to be a judge and it's going to be for 14 years, 18 years, and you can't run again. And so you don't have to worry about the back end kind of issue. The other thing too is you know, states can try and do more to facilitate competition. And it's really hard at the trial court level. Most trial court elections aren't contested. And so there's generally not a lot of interest, I guess, in these kind of elections. And so,
well, here in New York, they're cross-endorsed generally. The
right.
Judges get the cross-endorsements of all the parties who are interested in nominating judges. And you've got five cross-endorsed judges. Often the Green Party doesn't do it. But if you're not in one of the ballot access parties, you're just not going to be able to get on the ballot at all.
Right. There are certainly single-party dominated jurisdictions where, where maybe we want to think about ways to change that, or maybe move like for a trial court position, since the trial court's going to be less policymaking than state Supreme Courts. Maybe trial court judges should be selected differently than state Supreme Court judges. You know, that's certainly something some people have argued and given some thought to.
Well, of course, the other factor in New York is the party bosses like it this way. So
right.
There's it's unlikely to change.
Mm-hmm.
And just to follow up on some additional information, this is the first paper in a series of paper that we are doing on state judicial selection methods. We have two additional papers that should be coming out over the next year. But it looks like we have an additional question, so turning that over now.
Hi, my name's Tom Lillis. I'm in North Carolina. And just following on the last question concerning a minor party candidates for judges, in the nonpartisan elections, is there any scholarship on how many times they're won by non-major party candidates?
Almost zero. At least at the state Supreme Court level, I would say it's zero. Particularly in states where the parties can endorse. So in some states, parties are, they try and keep them from endorsing, but voters are able to tell. So that's the thing about nonpartisan elections, voters are able to tell which candidate represents which party. So what happens is you get fewer voters participating in nonpartisan elections, but the ones who participate, but so if you show, so my colleague David Cannon and I, for our last book, we ran some experiments, and we used real ads from real candidates in nonpartisan races. And we knew what party they were from because they had either had passed, you know, party service or they had been endorsed or whatever else. And we presented them to voters and said, hey, you know, which party is this guy? And about 80% of them could identify which candidate was a Democrat, which candidate was a Republican. And so there are ways, even nonpartisan races, for candidates to signal. But what happens, though, is you get less voter participation. So you're lopping off a whole bunch of voters. But you're still getting the partisan effects, and you're not getting any benefits from that. But to the best of my knowledge, a non-major party candidate has never won election, at least since 1990, to a state Supreme Court. I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, but that's what I've got.
And in North Carolina, certainly we'll see different groups distribute, I mean, make available online or even send out mailings saying, here are the candidates. If you are a Democrat, you should vote for these folks, and Republican, you should vote for these. Now, that doesn't necessarily, I mean, when we were nonpartisan, doesn't mean it's going to increase the turnout, but certainly there's the ability, as Professor Bond is talking about, to get that information, and those who really care about the courts would have access to it and know it. And that would be a key feature for lots of folks, I think, in the state, at least folks I've talked with about elections. That's a key piece of information, as Professor Bono argues in the paper, that folks want, because it's a really important key as to how this person may vote. Doesn't guarantee in all cases, but certainly important information with respect to how their judicial philosophy might be and how it might play out in particular cases.
Okay, thank you.
And it looks like we have one more question. Let's turn it over now.
Yeah, this is Dan Way, Carolina Journal in North Carolina. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the what seems to be the preferred proposal from our Republican majority here and how they want to change the election of judges. They're looking at a system where the public would nominate someone, or a person could self-nominate, and all those nominations would go to merit selection committee that would determine whether they were qualified or non-qualified. And then those qualified people would go to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly would then submit a list of 3 to 5 names to the governor to pick from that. And then the person who's chosen would have to stand for a retention election in the second general election following the appointment. And that would be limited to 10 years or some number. A lot of these details haven't really been worked out, but they would be able to serve out that term. It would be term limited, so they couldn't run for that office again. They could run for a lower court or a higher court, but they couldn't run for re-election to the same court. So I'm just wondering if that's too convoluted, too complicated for voters to understand. There doesn't seem to be a warm embrace of that from what I've seen so far. I'm just wondering Is there, I know it's a hybrid plan, nobody else has that, but is that even a workable situation?
Well, I think, I mean, it certainly could be workable. I'm, as you were describing it, I'm just trying to think what the benefits of that would be. Like, I mean, so it seems like you get the public involvement, right? So that's better than the traditional commission plan, and so maybe they're trying to make it more palatable to the public. Like, oh, you'll still be involved. But
right.
To me, that's involvement, you know, way, way down the chain and not in any kind of meaningful way. I mean, especially this whole thing that the, you know, the commission needs to decide who's qualified. Well, in North Carolina, you guys have a statute as to who's qualified. You have requirements as to who's qualified to sit on each court, right? And it involves having a law degree, and it may, in some states, it involves having a certain number of years of practice or whatever else. Anyone who meets those criteria, by definition, is qualified. So if someone were to nominate me, for example, then no, the commission says no, I'm not, but I wouldn't be allowed to run in a judicial election anyway because I'm not qualified, right? There are state qualifications. And so I don't understand. I mean, it seems to me that the public involvement here, maybe it's me just being cynical, is a very kind of they're throwing it in there to make it palatable to the public, but in terms of is it really public input? I find it hard to see how the public has any kind of meaningful input in that system you just described.
And I think the retention elections raise the same type of problems where, you know, and we've seen this when North Carolina considering some type of commission-based thing through the 90s and into the early 2000s, and or as recently as what, 2011, 2010, the idea of trying to get some type of participation, but retention rates on retention elections are so astronomically high, it's almost like a default lifetime appointment. It's possible, but very hard to do. And for the other reasons that Professor Bono was talking about before, it's not as meaningful a participation as a partisan judicial election where you're going against another candidate based on information, transparency, choice, all those things.
Well, thank you.
Well, if there are no additional questions, I would like to take the moment to thank our speakers, Professor Gaylord and Professor Bono, for taking the time out of their schedules today. It has been a tremendous benefit to the society as a whole for them to do this for us. We welcome additional listener feedback that you may have. Please feel free to email us at info@fedsoc.org. That's fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This teleforum is now adjourned. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For materials related to this podcast and for other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit us at the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.